Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome a new guest co-host, Dr. Shara Ortiz-Pujols. Welcome, Shara.
Well, thank you for having me, Dr. Goldstein.
Oh, you got to call me Adam. Adam. That's 50 cents you owe me already. You know, Shara, we've worked together in UNC's weight management program. You are an excellent counselor and an excellent doctor, and I'm sure your insights in today with our guests and our research will be really appreciative.
Thank you very much.
Let's dive right into our very first research before we end up talking with our guest, Dr. Betsy Olson, who will be talking about children who care for parents. And I think our very first research that matters actually could be part of that discussion because it's about the message that is given to people who have addiction. And I bet there's a lot of children who actually help care for parents who have addictions.
Yeah, it's important to understand, you know, how you label something and how it affects one's perception and how they deal with it. And it's important, especially for children, to kind of keep that in mind.
So in this particular research, what they're really looking at is providers, clinicians, when they have a patient who is addicted to a substance, they'll say, you know, addiction is a disease. And the reason I think we've said that for a long time is we want people to understand it's not as much necessarily about a choice or a behavior that implies something maybe non-medical, a moral judgment. We're trying to let people understand that things happen in the brain, and chronic addiction is like chronic high blood pressure, chronic diabetes. These researchers, though, want to take it a step farther. What are they trying to now do?
Well, what researchers are finding is that when you label something as a disease, it takes a sense of power away from the person. So the person may be less willing to try to do something because they feel that they have no control over it. So although we want to help people understand that a disease is something that changes the way the brain works, we also want people to still have a sense of autonomy and power that they can actually do something to change their situation.
And this was actually research out of North Carolina State University. And they were trying to see if, rather than talking about addiction as a disease, talk about it on what's called a growth mindset message. That, you know, things that are involved in our behavior are changeable, and that we might be developing and can develop some regulatory strategies, such as seeking help from others. And so they actually had 200 men and women who had substance abuse, and approximately half received this growth mindset message, and the other half received a message that addiction is a disease. Did they find any differences?
Well, they found that those that had the growth message had better outcomes, that they were able to actually do something. And this is something that we've also seen in our work with obesity, because when you kind of empower the patient and they feel that they can actually do something to change their circumstances. So there's that growth mindset. That's very important. And we need to be mindful of that as people who are taking care of people who have addiction or people who have obesity.
Yeah, they reported stronger intentions to seek counseling or cognitive behavioral therapy compared to those who got the disease message. It didn't show that they actually had better outcomes or that they went to the counseling. I think that's the next research.
That's correct. But the hope is that that will be the actual outcome. But at least they were more willing to take steps to try to change their situation, which is all we want. We want people to actually start to do something in order to change their circumstances.
Speaking of doing something, our next research that matters really is about doing something. And it's the question of what do we do when we're in kind of the middle ages of life to make sure we are healthy later in life? And does it matter? It matters.
It matters. And the other nice thing about this one is that it's never too late to do something, because sometimes we feel that we made all these choices as a younger person, and now there's nothing that we can do to change. But what this was showing, this is in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, they found that things that are done in middle age can actually help preserve and in some cases even prevent certain of these negative effects that go along with aging. So it was empowering because sometimes we need to hear that there's always an opportunity to do something that will improve our health.
Yeah, they were really looking at brain function, but brain function is measured not just with kind of psychological traits like attention, thinking, decision making, and memory, but also physical things that we may not think as much, but hearing and vision and ability to smell that actually are linked to brain function. And over 2,000 participants and found exactly as you said, that there are things that we kind of know, but related to cardiovascular disease like smoking or diabetes, even high blood pressure, really are linked in things that are less likely to show brain aging or things like exercising regularly. So it really shows this really critical link that we've been really talking about, but I think it shows it in ways that push us to say, you know what, you could really do something in the next year that could make it less likely that you're going to spend your time in a nursing home in 10 years from now, which maybe is walking regularly.
Right. And they found that people who smoked, this is something that can be changed. People who had larger weights, this is something that could also be changed, were more likely to show signs of brain aging. So they looked at both sides of it, and they found that if you don't do something or if you have these things, you will have more signs of aging. And if you exercise and eat healthier, you will prevent or slow down these signs of aging. So this was an excellent study highlighting those things.
Our next research that matters is also an excellent study. And it kind of looks on both sides of this area of, you know, people who are losing their vision are more likely to have anxiety and depression. But also, if you have anxiety and depression, you actually have some association with some vision loss, which I found kind of really interesting. But it definitely shows that we need to pay a lot more attention, I think, to things like vision. I would also say hearing and sense of smell and its relationship with mental health.
Absolutely. So the study, although it didn't find what came first and what caused what, but it showed a relationship between the two. And oftentimes we have somebody who may be experiencing some anxiety and depression, and it never goes through our mind to say, are you also having problems seeing? Is that maybe reason why you're having this anxiety and depression, or vice versa? So this study, which was done from the National Health and Aging Trends Study, kind of really brings to the forefront that we should at least be thinking about it and ask our patients about these things.
This was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, subspecialty journal, Ophthalmology. And I think it just is a little impressive for us to all think about for the people that we know, the people that we care for, that maybe are starting to decline in one sense, maybe not in their mental health yet, but if we can intervene, we might be able to do something to prevent that. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Betsy Olson, professor of geography and global studies at the University of North Carolina, about when children are responsible for providing care for other members of their families. We'll be right back with your health. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Chiara Ortiz-Pujols. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Betsy Olson, professor of geography and global studies at the University of North Carolina, about children who provide care for other members of their families. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Olson.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
We're really glad to have you here. And I think the topic is one that's really interesting and one that we don't talk about very much. But I see clinically in my office lots of times is young children who are with parents, and you know they're providing some care. In many cases, they're translating for parents who don't speak English, and you know then they're involved in the caregiving system. And I know we're going to dive in deep on this topic, but I guess first off, tell us a little bit about yourself and your path. We haven't had too many geographists or whatever the right term may be our show.
We are geographers, yes, and we do also do research in health and medical geography and well-being. The field is quite diverse, in fact. We have colleagues who work on everything from the impact of environment upon human behaviors that impact health. So things such as how many stores in your community can you purchase alcohol from? What is the availability of green space? Where can children play? We also have a lot of colleagues who do work that's much more similar to epidemiology. So looking at the intersections between wide-scale places of where you live and health impacts ranging from something like the spread of malaria to vaccines. And so
And how did you get interested in this field? Did you just wake up one day, you were 12 years old, you're caring for a parent, and you said, I want to study this?
Well, I became a geographer, actually, when I was a political scientist. And I took my first geography class as a political scientist. And all of a sudden, I thought, oh my gosh, this was when I was doing my PhD, in fact, I'm a geographer. And so I became a geographer really interested in themes of inequality. So the majority of my work has focused on different dimensions of inequality, and particularly the ways that everyday organization and institutions of our lives impact the capacity for people to make good choices and to be able to have opportunities. I've done that work initially in Latin America and then shifted to the United Kingdom, where I was working at the University of Edinburgh and started to become more interested in the ways that different aspects of inequality impact the well-being and livelihoods of young people. And so that's my story as a geographer. And this particular research comes from experiences that I had doing some studies in the UK.
Nice.
So it sounds like you've had a very fascinating kind of global experience. And can you kind of speak to how all of that contributed to your interests and your work? And what were transition points that kind of took you to your next step?
Yeah, I started off my research primarily interested in watersheds. So I was working in the United States, asking questions about how did people organize in order to manage resources under really kind of conflict-ridden environments. So watershed management in the Western United States is one of those contexts. And I realized that my interests were especially in the ways that we make decisions and how we incorporate or exclude certain voices from that decision making. And so that's a common theme that runs across my work. When I was conducting research in Peru for my PhD, I was primarily focused on the influences of religion and changing religion. Again, thinking about how do institutions of religion impact the opportunities that people have to live better lives, to be able to realize the types of dreams that they have, and then also how that then conflicts maybe with their economic context.
Is there a geographical basis for understanding the aspect of that religion and its impact on health outcomes?
Yes, absolutely. It's one of the more understudied areas within health and medical geography. But, you know, some of the things that we do know about spirituality and religiosity is that there's pretty profound and notable impacts. The kinds of things that I was looking into were the resources and opportunities that people could access as a result of their organizational affiliation. So, you know, being a member of a particular religious faith might give you access to someone coming to look in on you. It might give you access to a sense of community, or it might simply give you access to an actual physical resource like food.
Can you think of an example that you, when you were there, that you remember that kind of stuck with you, that, wow, this was really important?
Yeah, the faith communities that I was working with there, and particularly the Catholic Church, was very involved in violence, domestic violence against women in particular. And so these were opportunities that the women had to actually discuss and then plan, and in some cases, present an abusive spouse to a local police or some other group that could then you know, at least sit down and talk with them and try to enforce some kind of changes in behavior. So domestic violence is, you know, one example where religious communities have become really important as intervening characters.
Yeah. And it's kind of fascinating because I think sometimes we have a difficult time showing how connected and how alike we are. And working in Latin America and then working in Northern Europe kind of on the surface seem very different. But can you speak to what commonalities there are between these two areas and what lessons we can learn and how we can kind of better inform how we approach different health issues?
Absolutely. You know, what I began to become increasingly interested in were the informal networks that support people's well-being. So when families have complexities, when you have a family where there might be illness of an adult or a child, where resources are scarce, perhaps you are a recent immigrant or you do not have citizenship status, these kinds of impacts upon the potential for well-being and also the kinds of barriers that communities face, these seem to be ubiquitous across space. So, you know, as different as the experiences were of families in, you know, the highlands of the Provincias Altas in Peru and these families that I was working with in Glasgow, Scotland, those things were commonalities, that these informal networks were often able to communicate the kinds of barriers that families faced in well-being that other kinds of analyses couldn't quite pick up on. So we can look at policies and we can understand where those exclusions happen. But then to really understand, you know, other dimensions of limited access to resources, we had to look in these other places.
We're talking with Dr. Betsy Olson, Professor of Geography and Global Studies at the University of North Carolina. And Betsy, let's just open the conversation before we actually do a break about one of the areas that you are now doing a lot of research in. And it's about this kind of interaction between youth and children who might be caring for other members of the family. And I was just working recently in our homeless clinic, and I happened to come across a young refugee from El Salvador who came up to be essentially with the family that had been here, but he came alone 4 weeks, petrifying, terrifying. And yet now as the oldest sibling in a family, he's actually has caregiving for a grandparent. Is this a common or an uncommon situation?
Unfortunately, we do not know the answer to that. So the only study that has been done in the United States of youth caregiving took place in 2004, and the data was published in 2005. At that time, we knew that there's approximately 1.4 million young people who have these kinds of caregiving responsibilities.
In the United States alone.
In the United States alone. But
wow.
We also know that experts in Europe who've updated their figures since then, they suggest that this could be six times as many as what we detected in that original study. So the story that you tell me, I'm not surprised to hear it. Whenever I talk about this issue with people who are in healthcare, in education, in social work, they immediately begin to tell me stories like this. I remember a child who, I've been working with a young person that is in this situation, and the stories roll forward. The most interesting ones are often the ones where people look at me for a minute and then they say, you know, that was me. I took care of my grandparent. I took care of my father. And so we know that it is not uncommon, and one of our goals really is to try and collect this data. It's challenging to do for many reasons, but my collaborators and I are working very hard to improve our knowledge, just our basic knowledge about youth caregiving in the United States.
Well, you're improving our knowledge, which we appreciate, and your health listeners, but we do need to take a short break. And when we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Betsy Olson, Professor of Geography and Global Studies at the University of North Carolina, about children who provide care for other members of their family and the children's health themselves. We'll be right back with your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Chiara Ortiz-Pujols. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Betsy Olson, Professor of Geography and Global Studies at the University of North Carolina, about children and their provision of care for other members of their family and things that impact on their health as well.
So, Betsy, why do you think that this is such an unknown in this country? And why is it that you think we should really work hard to study it and understand it better?
Yeah, I wish I knew the answer to the first question. Why is it so understudied? I first found out about youth caregivers from research that I was conducting in the United Kingdom and Scotland, working with teams of young people to make films about what it means to grow up in areas of urban economic deprivation. And kind of by happenstance, I ended up working with a group of young carers, which is the term that's used to describe youth caregivers in most of the world, except the United States, where we use the term youth caregiving in order to correspond with several categories, government and policy categories. But I just happened to link up with a group of young carers in Glasgow, Scotland, and we were participating in filmmaking about what it meant to grow up in their neighborhood. And I, at first, did not appreciate what they were doing. I didn't understand the work that young people do as caregivers. So gradually, as I conducted this, you know, very involved work with them over a couple of years, I started realizing that this is an absolutely essential part of not only how families manage to provide care to family members who require it, but also was likely going to be a growing influence.
Give some examples of what you were witnessing.
Sure. So one of the young women that I worked with very closely, her younger sibling had a developmental disability and her mother had very severe epilepsy. And so they would have very difficult evenings. Some days she would come, you know, to work with our film group and her mom had been having seizures the night before. When that would happen, her sister would get very anxious. And so she would have the twin jobs of kind of watching over the two, her mom and her sister. Another young woman that we worked with, her mother suffered from severe mental illness and had attempted suicide that had also left her disabled. And so, you know, these were young people who would go to school every day. They go to school every day with our children. And we may or may not even know the kinds of care that they're undertaking at home, because there's a lot of barriers to divulging that information in the United States. There's too many people who don't understand what youth caregiving means, and a quick jump to assumptions that perhaps it's the same as neglect. And it's really quite different from neglect. And it's
I'm thinking about so many times I've seen things that evolve over a period of months. You know, I might be caring for a family or a parent, and I know the parent's alcohol abuse, and the child, though, you find out, is trying to keep the father from beating on the mother, and the child's not, quote unquote, neglected, but it's really caring for that family at a young age. Totally inappropriate, totally complex.
Absolutely. And we know that in some circumstances of youth caregiving, it goes further into this area that's also called parentification, where a child will assume a lot of duties that we generally associate with adults. We don't know what proportion of youth caregivers are in this situation, but we do know that the evidence that we've collected so far does not suggest that the majority of youth caregivers, if we broaden the category and we think about all the young people who are now helping to take care of a grandparent who've moved into a home of an adult child, that some of the consequences of youth caregiving can be increased empathy, great capacity and confidence and skill, and, you know, a true desire and interest to connect with others who might be in difficult circumstances.
So those are good things.
Yeah, those are all wonderful things. We see it, I always think of it as forking paths. For young people who are supported and who are doing appropriate roles of care and are still able to engage in healthy behaviors, things like socializing, things like being able to participate in school sports, carrying on responsibilities that are appropriate to their age level, they can really benefit from this kind of family caregiving. But then we also have other children who do not receive those supports, and they might be hiding a lot. They don't want the school to know, for instance, that they're engaging in the kind of care that you described for all of the consequences that might befall them. They tend to love the people that they care for, and so they want to protect them.
So these are incredible experiences for anyone of any age. So having had the opportunity to work with these children, how do they describe the experience? You mentioned parentification, right? How do they feel that it's affecting their life? Can you kind of give an anecdote or a story to kind of just make it not just from the 10,000-foot view, but make it more personal? Can you speak to that?
So one young woman who I was working with, she had a very challenging relationship with the parent that she was caring for. Really, really loved her. It was her mother. And spent a lot of time worrying about her. So one of the things that we know about youth caregivers, like any other caregiver, including adult caregivers, is that that care doesn't stop at the household doorstep. They worry about the kinds of care that they have to provide throughout the day when they're sitting in school. They might worry about the individual who's back home and, you know, wondering whether they have what they need. And so she described oftentimes, you know, just being worried. She was worried a lot. She was hoping that her mom was okay. And one day I was riding home in a taxi with her from some film work that we had done. And she said, you know, it's really been hard to grapple with some of the decisions that my mom's made and the situation that we're in right now because of it. Again, her mom not being able to really take care of herself because of mental illness. And she said, but, you know, the thing is that I really know how much she loves me, and I don't know what I would do without her. And so these are really very complex relationships, as are any caregiving relationships. The difference is that in the United States, we do not recognize children as caregivers. We don't teach about them in medical school. We don't teach about them in social work schools. We don't teach about them to our teachers or our school nurses. Our policies exclude any person under the age of 18 as being categorized as a caregiver. And so in contrast to adult caregivers who are receiving services, youth caregivers aren't even acknowledged as caregivers. They're not recognized. And one of the things that these young people say is how lonely they feel. They feel so alone, as if they're the only one doing this work. And yet we know that there's many other kids just in their own school, probably in their own grade, possibly even in their own classroom, who are doing not exactly the same thing, but very similar kinds of care for their families. So, yeah, that's the big difference between the United States and other places where youth caregiving is recognized.
You know, and I think about the things that we offer for teens. You know, if their parents are alcoholic, we have Al-Anon. If there's narcotics, we have Nar-Anon. We have ways of supporting kids in support groups, but I've never heard of support group in this. And I'm thinking that you mentioned kind of that the United States doesn't have kind of this policy, this recognition. And we've been talking about that at the patient level, but what's the macro, what's the policy level discussion that's going to help support all this work at the clinical level?
Yeah. You know, the research priorities at this point really are to understand the prevalence of youth caregiving. We have to know how many are in the United States now. We do have one really excellent model of intervention at a school district level. That is the Caregiving Youth Project in West Palm Beach County, Florida. And they have supports that run in the schools. They've had phenomenal success with things like graduation rates, with improvements in mental health, with even just being able to provide services like teaching kids how to cook healthy meals for their families, buying them a crock pot so that they can make these meals for them, making sure that they have safe transportation. So very basic things, putting in ramps, wheelchair ramps, to make it easier so that children don't have to lift their family members. These are all, you know, rather modest material changes in youth's lives that seem to be paying off in spades in terms of their overall flourishing and well-being. So You know, the difficulty is how do we replicate that? So the other thing that we're trying to figure out is what are the other models for intervention? One of my collaborators up in Wisconsin, Melinda Cavanaugh, has been working for a very long time with families with ALS and Huntington's. And she's produced these great graphic novels, comic books that help kids to understand, you know, your concerns about how you provide care might be very similar to other kids. And it's okay to talk about it, and it's okay to think about it. And there's other folks who are doing the same thing. And, you know, removing barriers to flourishing at schools in particular, where we see is kind of, you know, there's ground zero for where we can either have insurmountable barriers or get rid of all of them for youth caregivers.
And maybe we're all talking more like we're doing today, but maybe the providers talking with the school teachers, talking with the librarian who's talking with the child, and we have these collaborative, wonderful conversations.
Absolutely. And providers are so important. So another colleague of mine, Julia Belkowitz at the University of Miami, has been driving a lot of research to understand everything from how children deal with administering medication to the awareness among pediatricians of youth caregiving. So we're hoping to have some more information about that soon. But, you know, it would change a lot if pediatricians would ask the question, do you help to take care of someone at your home? How does this impact you? And then begin to imagine together what resources can we pull together in the same way that we've done for adult caregivers. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit. So that's I consider myself a harvester of low-hanging fruit.
Well, I think we need to be eating that fruit and moving into the conversation. We really want to thank you. We're going to have to put a bookmark in this, but it's an important space and place that you're filling. And we're so glad there are medical geographists who fill the space and help bring us together across maybe disciplines.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
We've been talking with Dr. Betsy Olson, Professor of Geography and Global Studies at the University of North Carolina, about children and their care for other members of the families and care for the children, too. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Ciara Ortiz-Pujols. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I'm a young man who likes to swim. Every summer after swimming, it seems like I get an ear infection. I know this happens a lot to kids, but I really thought I would outgrow it by now. Is there anything I can do to prevent getting these infections?
You're a little bit ahead of me because I like to swim, but I don't think I've ever had an ear infection from swimming. So do you think that there's something unusual going on here, or is this more like swimming in lakes and, you know, so you're exposed to different sorts of bacterium?
Sometimes how the ear is shaped can predispose people to get more ear infections. So in his case, he had them when he was a young child, and his ear probably didn't change. So he's probably going to be more at risk of getting them. And whether he swims in a lake or whether he swims in the beach or in a pool, I don't think it's as important as making sure that the ear is dry after he swims, making sure that he drains all the fluid out of his ears. Even maybe using some cotton, but nothing more than cotton, not sticking anything into his ears, because that's going to introduce badness into his ears. And then there are some homemade remedies that he could potentially try both before and after swimming.
That maybe help dry out the ear. Because there's that moisture, sitting water that sometimes can lead to
exactly, because it's sitting water in a warm, dark place, which is perfect environment for all types of bacteria and fungus to grow. So if you take one part white vinegar, one part alcohol, mix it together, and rinse each ear out, rinse it in, put it in, and then make sure you drain everything out.
Maybe like a dropper.
A dropper, exactly, just like you would do.
A few drops,
A few drops. That will help dry out the ear a little better. So you dry it out and then you put this in there. It helps that dry it up even more. And hopefully that should decrease some of those infections.
I think we'll also ask our health science librarians to put up a little patient education information sheet on swimmer's ear. I know the Mayo Clinic and others have some really good ones, mm-hmm. and put it up there because I think it's kind of common but not talked about a lot.
That's exactly right.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
I have a fungal infection on all my toenails. I recently went to see my doctor to get them treated, even though I have no symptoms, but my doctor discouraged this because treatments work only about half the time. I forgot to ask if I can still get pedicures, which I like to get because it hides the problems that you can see on my nails. What do you think about this?
There's a fungus among us, as they would say, we would get taught, you know? This is, you know, I mean, fungal nail infections are one of the most common things that any provider will see or any patient has. And a lot of people like pedicures. And so you put those two things together. The question is, well, if you got fungal infection on all your nails, can you get a pedicure? Will that make it worse? Will it spread it to other people? What do you think?
So the purist in me would say, do not get a pedicure. But as a woman who also enjoys pedicures, I can certainly understand that the massage and all that sensation, that pampering is a wonderful thing. So maybe one thing to do would be to bring your own tools. That way you don't have to worry about spreading it to others or having it spread to you, and you can still have all the benefits of a pedicure.
And even it could be limited pedicure, may not involve the cuticles, but just sanding the nails, trimming them down, little foot massage, the things that actually can make you feel better, and maybe even some polish that may actually hide some of the way you feel the unsightliness of the nails. What's our very last house call, Laura?
I've had migraines for over 10 years, and I've always gotten medicine from my family doctor. Recently, a friend suggested, however, that I might do better by going to a specialist at a headache clinic. There's a wait of 6 months, and I'm just curious if you think it's worth it.
Now, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised. There are really way fewer people who specialize in headaches that around the country than people who would really like to get to see them.
But there are really effective treatments that are out there that are not just medication. Botox, which you can potentially get from a headache specialist, plastic surgeon, or even an ENT, have been found to be incredibly effective in managing migraines because what it does is that it relaxes the muscle that oftentimes is pressing on that blood vessel that's causing the migraine. So it kind of just like it helps with release the muscles that cause the wrinkles, it'll do the same thing to that muscle that's triggering the migraine. So there are some really effective therapies aside from pills that you might want to wait the 6 months in order to see a doctor and to discuss.
And you might want to just bring it up with your primary care physician. You know, just say, hey, listen, at 6 months, could we do some other things? I mean, if you're doing well, it's hard to do better than well. So maybe you're doing well, you may not need to. I assume that there's some things that are not going as well here. Talk about, you know, maybe the doctor hasn't prescribed them before. Maybe the doctor is willing to prescribe. Maybe you're willing to learn together. And, you know, including behavioral treatments and stress reduction and massage and looking at your diet and your sleep. I think we could do a whole show on this. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. Please share any questions by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank our guest co-host, Dr. Shara Ortiz-Pujols, and our guest today, Dr. Betsy Olson. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill. the Hill, your community radio station.